Excuse me. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Michael Gibbons in Carson City. I'm joined today by Judge Jerry Tao in Las Vegas and Judge Bonnie Bulla in Las Vegas. We are conducting our oral arguments today by Blue Jeans video. It worked fine this morning, so hopefully it'll continue on and we'll have good luck this afternoon. Welcome to counsel for both sides. I see Mr. Chen on my right and Mr. Sheets on my left. Judge Tao, would you like to say anything?
No, other than it's good to see you guys again. Thanks for commenting at us by doing our oral argument this way, but that's the world we live in now, and looking forward to the argument.
Judge Bulla?
Good afternoon. I know it's probably a little bit difficult because Judge Tao and I have our masks on, but we're sitting together in Las Vegas, so we are being very careful. And if you have any difficulty understanding us, please let us know, and we'll certainly do our best to be helpful. So thank you, and we're looking forward to hearing from both of you.
Okay. We're the first case on for this afternoon is number 80072-COA, Henry Aparicio versus the state of Nevada. This is the time set for the oral argument, and both counsel are present. Appellant goes first with 15 minutes. Mr. Sheets, would you like to reserve any of that time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I respectfully request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, 3 minutes. All right, you'll hear a buzz when there's 3 minutes left, and also you should be able to see the clock on the screen with the counter. Okay. If anything goes wrong, don't go anywhere. We have backup procedures. If nothing else, the telephone. All right, Mr. Sheets, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak for you on these issues today. Respectfully, as we look forth at this case brings forward a couple of unique issues. Specifically, the first issue that we are addressing here is whether or not a defendant is entitled to a new sentencing hearing when the district court considers over 100 pages of victims' impact letters or supposed victims' impact letters from friends, distant families, co-workers, supervisors, and many other individuals who have not even known the actual victim of an offense, and whether or not that would qualify them under some broad long-arm definition of victims under the Nevada statute or the Nevada Constitution, specifically as we address Marcy's Law. The second issue that we need to address in this hearing is whether or not a defendant is entitled to a new sentencing hearing when the district court considers letters and additional evidence by either video or posters or demonstrative exhibits outside those presented through the two specific means that are set forth under Nevada law. Finally, additionally, this court is to consider whether or not a defendant should be entitled to a new sentencing hearing when the district court permits speakers to adversely comment not only on the impact to them, the defendant, to them, their families, comment on the defendant or their economic harm, but to additionally speak on an exercise of constitutional rights by the defendant, attacks on the system, attacks on the agency preparing a pre-sentence investigation report, and qualifying certain constitutional rights of the defendant as insults to law enforcement's wild lies, attempts to escape justice, and the likes. This was an interesting case. As it went to sentencing, the district attorney's office or the victim's impact unit submitted over 100 pages, specifically 101 pages of victim impact statements. And many of these objections were made, or many of these statements were presented by individuals who were not directly related to or connected to the victims in this particular case. This was a case where there was a DUI death, and the defendant, Mr. Aparicio, pled guilty and proceeded to sentencing to two counts of DUI death and additional charges. At the sentencing hearing, and prior to the sentencing hearing, many objections were lodged by defense counsel, specifically arguing that these written statements did not fall within the definition of a victim as Nevada law would put it forth. In particular, there are several cases that kind of address the definition of a victim, or there are several issues that address the definition of a victim. Now, as the court is well aware, Marcy's Law has recently been passed, and as part of Marcy's Law, there has been, a movement towards victims' rights as it pertains to Nevada law. And as part of Marcy's Law, there's a definition that's put forth. When looking at what a victim is for Nevada law, it is first and most important to look towards the Nevada revised statutes, which define that. And in pertinent part, NRS 176.015 defines a victim or includes as a victim a person against whom a crime has been committed, a person who's been injured or killed as a direct result of the commission of the crime, and I emphasize direct as part of that, or a relative as described in the two other subparagraphs. Specifically, then Marcy's Law, which is Nevada Constitution Article 1, Section 8A, describes a victim as any person directly and proximately harmed by the commission of a criminal offense under the laws of the state. And it's important that we look at the statement directly and proximately harmed. And I would point out that that's a very similar statement that you see in NRS 176.015, where it requires it be somebody against whom a crime has been committed, a person who has been injured as a direct result of the commission of the crime, or a relative of the person.
So what's the relationship between the two? Marcy's Law is a constitutional amendment, and then you have this statute, NRS 176.015, which was enacted 20-something years ago. Are you saying that the two definitions are the same? Are you saying that one overrules the other? Or is there some way to read them together, considering that they're not exactly worded the same?
Specifically, it is our position that they can be read in complete harmony. Nevada, if you were to actually look at the definition, or as it's written out in Marcy's Law, directly and proximately harmed, then there would need to be an additional analysis that would be conducted. What exactly is defined, or what is a direct victim, or what's direct and proximate? As we look at the law, again, Nevada hasn't had the opportunity to interpret this, so that specific question might be one of first impression. But there are other states we can look to. Specifically, if we look at State v. Jones in the state of Ohio, it talks about a victim being somebody who has suffered direct economic loss.
Marcy's Law has this broad phrase directly and proximately, right? But it doesn't have a separate definition of family members. So couldn't someone argue that Marcy's Law actually overrules the statutory definition of family member? Because people who are directly and proximately harmed can be more than just family members.
Well, I would respectfully disagree with that position. And I think that's why it's important to note direct and proximately harmed. The direct language, I think, specifically relates to the relationship between that individual and a victim. Direct and proximate. It doesn't say just proximate. And if the state made a great deal in their answering brief of arguing that simply showing approximate harm is sufficient, but that's not what Marcy's Law requires. It requires that the two be together. It has to be approximate and a direct. And so in this particular instance, the question then becomes, how far out does that direct act reach? And that's why I would pose that the case law out of Ohio, Montana, and California, which are the only three states who have addressed this specific issue out of the eight that have dealt with Marcy's Law, kind of address.
Let me throw a hypothetical out at you, okay? Let's say a baby is abandoned by his parents, and they never see him again till he's 18. In the meantime, he's raised by foster parents who never bother to legally adopt him. He dies at 18, killed by a drunk driver. The family members don't have any, the actual family members, the actual biological parents have no relationship to this kid, but the people who raised this kid have no family relation to them. So who gets to write a letter in this circumstance under the statute and the Constitution? Do the parents who haven't seen this kid in 18 years, are they directly and proximately harmed? And do the foster parents who are not family members, are they not allowed to write a letter because they're not family members?
Well, I would argue that when somebody is a foster parent, they have actually been legally been deemed to be a custodian of that specific child. The court has determined that usually the family court, the district court, has determined that that person is fit and proper to have been the custodian of that child.
Okay, so what about the biological parents who abandoned this kid? Do they necessarily have information that's used to the court just because they're blood relations to this child, even though they haven't laid eyes on him in 18 years?
Well, if you were to read the statute as NRS 176.015 reads, then they would have a right because they are a biological parent or a relative, as would be defined.
But on the other hand, you can argue that they're not directly and proximately harmed by the death of someone they haven't seen in 18 years. So that brings me to the question of how does Marcy's Law, which doesn't have a definition of family member, but does say directly and proximately, how does that relate to the family member requirement?
I would argue that the statute can be read in harmony with Marcy's Law. And Marcy's Law would put forth a constitutional minimum, which is required for somebody to speak. You can have two bases for somebody to be allowed to speak. You can have a constitutional right to speak, but you can also have a statutory right to speak. So while Marcy's Law specifically states that you have to be directly and proximately harmed, in addition to the directly and proximately harmed, the NRS 176.015 provides an additional avenue for additional people to speak who might not be directly and proximately harmed. And so all that's doing is conveying an additional right by a statutory right to a victim, as is listed specifically under that statute. So there's nothing in the statute that's taking away from what Marcy's Law allows, but it's actually adding additional people who might have the right to speak.
Mr. Sheets, is there a provision where the court could have considered the 100 pages, as you've indicated, independent of Marcy's Law, looking at the statutory language?
We would respectfully say no for a couple of reasons, specifically as it pertains to the content, the form through which it was presented, and also the individuals who were making statements.
Specifically what he's talking about is Section 6, which says this section does not of NRS 176.015, which says this section does not restrict the authority of the court to consider any reliable or relevant evidence at the time of sentencing. That seems like kind of a catch-all provision, right?
Well, if we were to adopt that position, the policy implications of that would be incredibly broad. It would essentially turn sentencing into a free-for-all where the defendant could bring in his own family, his mother, his brother, his sister, his son, his children, because they would then be able to talk about the impact upon them of having somebody incarcerated for a longer period of time, of having him put in prison for, in this particular case, a minimum of 14 years in the Nevada Department of Corrections. But certainly that's not what the courts had in mind. That's certainly not what the legislature would have in mind. So it would go, then I think the catch-all provision would be something similar to you look at Marcy's Law. That which is relevant and that which is that which may be relevant and usable at sentencing would be something that fits within that direct and proximate cause. Because, again, the constitutional amendment is a constitutional amendment, and it may say that it's a victim's rights amendment, but it is still a constitutional amendment and still imports rights to a defendant. And a defendant now would have a right to not have any statements beyond the scope of Marcy's Law, which is direct.
So, Mr. Sheets, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Is what you're saying is once these documents are classified as victim statements, you have to follow Marcy's Law. That's what you have to look at to determine whether or not they should be considered.
I think the purpose of whether or not it's relevant and applicable at sentencing specifically is the minimum requirement is set forth in Marcy's Law. So the question of whether it's relevant, I think good guidance would be Marcy's Law, because that is the minimum which is required. If this statement, if this person is classified as a victim, or to be classified as a catch-all victim, I believe that Marcy's Law would be that, because that sets the minimum. Are they were they directly and proximately impacted by this crime? And I think that as we look at the cases that have interpreted that, the actual interpretation in the state of Ohio talks about a victim as, the California interpretation talks about a victim being one who suffers direct, threatened, physical, psychological, or financial harm.
And so let me ask you this. So Judge Tao, hold on
okay. a second. Mr. Sheets, you said you wanted to save 3 minutes, and now you're only at a little over 2 minutes.
Okay.
All right. Judge Tao, we can go ahead. I can just add extra time. I don't know what Mr. Chen will say about that, but if you want to go ahead.
Well, if you don't mind, let me just ask this question, and maybe we can just not run the clock while he's answering it, because it's a pretty important question. I can ask it during rebuttal, I guess. Let's just do it during rebuttal. That's fine. I don't want to take away from Mr. Chen's time either and make you guys run long.
Oh, well, I have one quick question, Mr. Sheets. Keep it really quick. Did the district court make any attempt to distinguish between the information that was submitted to say, this letter comes in, this one doesn't, or part of this letter comes in, or part of that letter comes in, or was everything handled as one total, and it just all came in, and there was no distinction between anything and all of this information?
It was handled as one broad acceptance of all of the evidence. Specifically, the court said, I believe the Nevada Constitution defines victims broadly, and therefore I accept everything and consider that in rendering my sentence here today. That's the specific quote.
All right. Thank you for the concise answer. All right. You'll have 2 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Chen, you have 15 minutes. Go ahead.
Thank you, and good afternoon. Alexander Chen on behalf of the state of Nevada as the respondent. So the actions of appellant on the night of May 15th, 2018, forever altered the lives of two loving parents and at least 46 individuals who felt compelled to write the sentencing court letters about how this crime impacted them. These letters came in the form of relatives, friends, coworkers, sometimes friends of the family, who were able to see the impact that the crimes had on the victim's parents. These letters recounted Krista and Damaso Puentes from the time of their childhood all the way until the time that they took their last breaths. Now, as Justice Gibbons just asked the question, was there anything that the district court did to distinguish anything about the letters that were submitted? Well, one thing that the state would point out is there was nothing objectionable in them. If you read the letters, they were focused on the victims. There was nothing, for instance, that was even possibly objected to because it would be something that was not permitted by law. So these letters came from all individuals. And for this court to agree with appellant, it would mean that the passage of a constitutional amendment, which was meant to act as a shield for the rights of victims, would instead serve as a sword that impales a sentencing court from hearing the very personal and devastating impact that crime can have. Now, we're talking about two different provisions of the law here. We have NRS 176.015 and Article 1, Section 8 of the Nevada Constitution, which is also known as Marcy's Law. These laws were both meant to expand and guarantee the rights of victims. They were not meant to limit what a sentencing court could consider. In fact, up until 1989, when NRS 176.015 subsection 3 was created, victims were not automatically guaranteed a voice in court. It was up to the sentencing court to decide if it wished to hear from the victims. And if it didn't want to, there was no provision that guaranteed that the victims could express their feelings about the case. Everything was merely subject to the discretion of the sentencing court. However, when 176.0153 was passed to give the victims a statement, it's even been tweaked since the time that it was passed. And what I mean by that is we've discussed today, what does the term victim mean? Victim is determined by statute. Victim is defined in Marcy's Law. But what we run into if you take such a narrow reading of either of those versions of the law is you get a case like Wood versus State 111 Nevada 428, which was briefed. In that particular case, you have a mother who comes in to testify about at a sentencing about a lewdness that's taken place on her child. It was objected to that she didn't fall within the confines of the statute because the statute allowed for a surviving parent. Now, obviously, in a lewdness case, as terrible as the facts are, the child is still living. So the defendant in that case objected, and the Supreme Court determined that the statute was meant to expand and guarantee the rights of victims. It was not meant to limit it, and especially limit it to a case that would lead to an absurd result like Wood, where the victim's own parent wasn't specifically enumerated by the statute. As the Supreme Court also pointed out in Randall versus State 109 Nevada 5, these type of laws are meant to expand the rights of victims, not to constrict them.
Mr. Chen, I agree with you 100% on that. You might, if you looked at the legislative history, you'll see that I'm one of the persons that submitted a bill in 1994 to the 1995 legislature to expand 176.015 and do exactly what you said, that this provides minimum guaranteed rights to victims. It doesn't restrict the application of information. I mean, if you qualify as a victim, you get to do certain things no matter what. And one of the phrases that I added was in an earlier part of the statute. It says you can appear through a personal representative. So in a case of a parent or where there's a minor, I mean, somebody can be designated to speak for the child, even though the person is not deceased. So that was handled in the amendments in 1995. And subsection 6 that Judge Tao referred to earlier was to make it clear that this was expanding rights. It was not restricting rights in any way whatsoever. The Castillo case was mine. That point was made in that case because in that situation, someone that wasn't the parent but represented the parent spoke for the child. And so that came in. And I'm bringing this all up because the point of this statute is that you have a guaranteed right. So if you come under the definition of a victim, you have these guarantees. But we have a number of actors in this case who wrote letters that do not come within the definition. I think you're going to have to agree with that. I mean, there's just no way they come under the definition. So the question is, what do they get to say? And they can present information just like anybody else that either side wants to call, the state or the defense. And the court can determine if it's relevant or reliable information that should be considered. So my question to you is, most of the information appears to be okay if it's presented. But the reason I asked the question to Mr. Sheets is, if the court just treated it all as the same and made no individual distinction as to the type of information, was that improper? Because what happened here is that each person, slews of non-victims, were able to comment on things that only victims can say, like what the sentence should be. How can somebody off the street tell the court what the sentence should be?
Well, I think what the letters indicate, even from individuals who weren't as close to the victims in this case, is that they talked about the impact that it had on the victims still, as victims' parents in this case, as well as what the sentence should be. And I agree that the victims have an absolute right to do that, but the court is still able to consider all of their statements. And I don't think that the court needs to distinguish between them because, for instance, if a letter comes as happened in this case, some of the individuals were friends of the parents. They didn't know the children as well who passed away in the car collision. But what they were still able to do is express exactly what had happened, how it impacted them, and the court was able to say, okay, this person doesn't know the victims as well, so I'm going to assign less of a weight to their particular letters. But then if it was someone close who grew up with the children, they could consider the impact on those individuals.
Do you know of any cases where a court has ruled that a non-victim can give a recommendation as to what the sentence should be?
there might not be a specific case, but I think Randall versus State specifically indicates that a court is able to weigh these things. A court is trained to not take into consideration things if it feels it's inappropriate. And then Justice Beal, I believe you were going to say something. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chen. Yeah. Doesn't that put us a little bit on a slippery slope, though, because in any type of sentencing case, a judge could consider multiple letters, perhaps from all over the world, of people writing in and expressing an opinion as to an appropriateness, the appropriateness of a sentence. And doesn't that give us some concern in terms of making sure the sentencing is fair?
I think a judge is certainly able to consider all factors. And as Mr. Sheets pointed out, a defendant could very well have letters written on his or her behalf. And it's happened. All of you who have served at the district court level know that letters come in oftentimes asking for a more lenient sentence. So if you make the same argument that a defendant is able to make an argument for a lenient sentence from various individuals that have come into contact with him or her, then why would it be that a victim would be precluded from, or people related to the victim be precluded from making equal arguments?
I'm thinking of victims letters, though, that are from people that have no relationship to the victim, not family members, maybe friends that didn't even know the victim. And we had a couple, I think, in this case where they knew family members of the victim.
Yes.
I mean, does that concern us in terms of ensuring that the information that the court weighs is appropriate?
I think it's all a balancing act. I think, though, that in this particular case, you won't find anything that the court did improper in terms of her consideration of the various letters. And I would point out that these letters did focus mainly on the impact that the crimes had. Yes, most of them had a concluding phrase which asked for a maximum sentence and a consecutive sentence, which I would point out the court did not give a maximum sentence in this particular case. There were consecutive sentences, but it wasn't the maximum as requested by most of these letters. So I think that also lends credence to the fact that the judge was not improperly influenced by these letters and by the recommendations that the absolute maximum sentence be given in this particular case.
Right.
Well, understanding that the district court does not have to follow the recommendations in the PSI, the judge did not follow those recommendations in this case, correct?
Correct.
You know, Mr. Chen, if the Division of Parole and Probation recommended concurrent or consecutive on the three sentences?
I can't remember exactly. I know it was a 3-8, Justice Givens, and I believe it was concurrent, but it might have been consecutive, so I'm not entirely positive about that. Okay. But I know that we argued, the state did argue for a consecutive sentence and did argue for more than the 3-8 sentence, and I believe that the prosecutor at the time argued that this particular statute encompasses anything from a broken bone to death. And that for a sentence of 3-8, that would be certainly on the low end of two individuals who were killed in this particular case.
Right, and the court imposed the maximum upper range, so 20 years was the maximum. So two 20-year sentences consecutive, and then a consecutive sentence on the reckless driving, too, that the state had agreed to recommend concurrent on.
Correct. Yes, that's true, but as this court also knows, the district court is not bound by anything there and could consider all factors.
Right, yeah.
I mean, this was in a particularly egregious case. I'm sorry to interrupt, Justice. But it was an egregious case. She didn't give the district court, that is, didn't give the absolute maximum, though. And I would point out another case as well the Nevada Supreme Court came out with, Dayudon versus State, 127 Nevada 1, in which the victim speakers used certain words and racial epithets that were spoken at the sentencing, but the sentencing was still upheld because there was no indication that those words, which I should also say were by friends of the victim, so this was a murder case in which two friends of the victim came in to testify, not two family members. And there was nothing improper about that because the court didn't rely upon those. There was nothing to indicate speculate that the court had relied upon those. And instead, the court relied upon and had mentioned the extensive criminal history of the defendant in that particular case in handing out the sentence. So what I would also say, and one thing that Justice Tao had kind of postured the question earlier, was can NRS 176.015 and Marcy's Law work together? And I would argue that they absolutely can. There's nothing of one that is contradictory to the other. Again, these were meant to expand the rights of victims, not to preclude other individuals from making arguments. I would also point out that Marcy's Law in subsection 6 says that the legislature shall provide by law any other measure necessary or useful to secure the rights of victims, useful to secure to victims of a crime the benefit of the rights set forth in this section. So what I would argue there is an argument like, or a statute like NRS 176.015 is exactly the type of statute they're talking about. That statute might even continue to be reworked, as Justice Givens pointed out. In 1995, there was changes to it. There were changes in it in 2001. Things continue to progress as the law changes and the legislature continues to modify what's appropriate. But certainly, there's nothing about those statutes that are contradictory to each other. So I think in this case, it's easy to reconcile both of them and to argue that the court did something absolutely proper. I would finally just point out that the cases that Mr. Sheets is pointing to about Marcy's Law, those are trying to be inclusive of who a victim is. So, for instance, a friend or one of these family members or family friends wouldn't be able to assert these rights. This is to get included into those laws. But there's nothing that guarantees them the right. That's left to judicial discretion. What we're talking about here is that the court, and if I could just finish the sentence.
Go ahead.
Is that the sentencing court was able to use its judicial discretion to consider these factors and then to render an appropriate sentence. And for that, I think that the sentence should be upheld.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chen. All right, Mr. Sheets, you have two more minutes.
So, yes, Mr. Sheets, let me ask you the question I was going to ask you, just so you can think about it. So if Section 6 of the statute is not a catch-all, this is my question about how the statute and the Constitution work then, right? Normally, relevance is determined by the content of the information, not by the title of the speaker, right? That's just how the evidence code works. That's 48.015 definition of relevance. Is the information relevant? If Section 6 is not a catch-all provision, then what you have here is a statute and a Constitution that focus solely on the title of the speaker and say that what they are saying is relevant. And if you are not a correct speaker, then what you're saying is not relevant. So if that's how you read the statute, when can the district court ever consider information that is highly relevant under the normal definition of relevance from a person who's not a statutory family member or a constitutional family member?
Yes, Your Honor. I personally would believe that, again, I believe that the catch-all provision was intended for, as it's been expressed, was intended to be something that that Marcy's Law puts out there to put forth. I think Marcy's Law clarifies that which might exist in a catch-all provision must be direct and proximate. So if you fit on that column, then it's acceptable. And I think that Marcy's Law's interpretations as set forth in California, Montana and Ohio make it very clear that you have to be the target or directly related to the target or substantially related to, like whether in your custodial thing, custodial hypothetical, you have to be that substantially related. Getting to something that I heard Justice Biela saying earlier, though, I think it's important. What we're looking at is we have a situation where the court actively did not make a differentiation here between those from those letters that made statements that were improper and those letters that were written by people that are well outside of the scope of any of these rules. Somebody who is a coworker of a parent of a victim who did not know the victim certainly is not in a position to have been directly and, it's important because of the and, proximately affected by that. To allow these statements in would be to allow extra prejudice to enter a proceeding against a defendant who's been guaranteed rights. And Your Honors were right. In this particular case, the state agreed that it would run concurrent. The reckless would run concurrent to the DUIs, and they were allowed to argue. No, the court did not give the maximum, but the court gave 1 year shy of the maximum, ran a consecutive, and then added a consecutive reckless. And in that statement was a blanket statement that everything was considered. Specifically, in Dudion versus State, this court, the Nevada Supreme Court, specifically said that the reason that sentencing stood was because Judge Smith expressed the criminal history was the primary reason. There was not a reference to him considering those unsworn statements, if I may just briefly finish.
Go ahead.
In that particular case, he did not consider the unsworn statements. Here we have an affirmative statement from the district court that those statements were considered, and they were considered in an unlawful way, and that they were unlawfully presented as put forth in the only two possible forms under Bushower v. State.
Right. Mr. Sheetsart, I'll ask you the same thing I asked Mr. Chen. Are you aware of any cases where a court ruled on the propriety of a non-victim giving a recommendation to the court as to sentencing?
Specifically, as to a recommendation, I am unaware of any cases. As to the propriety, as they were pertained to Marcy's Law, I would just refer to the brief.
Okay. Thank you. Our other cases we set for argument today were part of the pro bono program, so we always set those for argument. This one obviously was not. We thought that it was a very important issue that should be brought to the court and heard more thoroughly than we typically do on sentencing cases. We decide hundreds of sentencing cases every year, and this is the first time I can remember we've actually set one for an argument. So the information is helpful. This is new, Marcy's Law. The connection between the statute is something to be sorted out here, and both of you have commented on that, so that's very helpful. In fact, everything both of you said was very helpful, so I think we made a wise choice setting this for argument. So this matter will be taken under submission for a decision, written decision, as soon as we can. Judge Tao, do you have any concluding comments?
No, other than I think it's an interesting issue, and it was a good and very enjoyable argument. And thanks, everybody.
Judge Bullitt.
Excellent job, both of you. Thank you so much. It was very helpful.
Okay. And you could see I'm very interested in this topic, too, having submitted legislation on the matter back when I was a deputy district attorney, but then testifying when I was a district judge. So different roles. All right. Thank you. Thank you both very much. And again, we'll get this out as soon as we can.
Thank you.
All right. We'll be in recess.